Hey, welcome in. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is the All Ball Podcast. Thanks so much for making us part of your queue, right? That's what we call it. It's really interesting to me on how we use these British words, European words, for only specific things. Oh, the queue, right? But you would never be in line at Blaze Pizza and say, I'm queuing, which is what they say when you're in Europe. Only we'll use it for podcasts. Anyway, thanks so much for making us part of your queue, putting us on your podcast list. Tell a friend to download and to subscribe and rate. Don't forget, rate us. That somehow helps us. And if it helps us, that means it helps me financially. Anyway, this is the Final Four edition. And if you really love Final Four stuff, you should tune in daily to the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio and our foxsportsradio.com, or download the Doug Gottlieb Show podcast, which is available daily, where we'll have a litany of guests, college basketball coaches, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Let's start with the Final Four teams. I'll get to a couple of the hires, and then we'll get to our guest of the week. I guess if there's an overall narrative, it's that good basketball teams made of veteran players and quality coaches that play great defense wins, you know? And we live in this weird age, strange age, where, you know, like coaches get bonuses for things and suddenly it's, why are the players paid? I'm like, okay, well, I don't want to do another podcast on how on the value of playing and how that helps you with your first job and helps you with your image. But, I mean, look at Zion Williamson. Zion Williamson now as opposed to Zion Williamson a year ago. Okay, so Zion Williamson a year ago, do you think he signs the biggest shoe contract maybe ever? The answer is no. No, he's a YouTube sensation. If he goes to the G League, maybe if he goes to Clemson or South Carolina, two other programs that he could have gone to in his home state. But he goes to Duke, and then, of course, he benefits not just from tearing off his shoe, but doing so against North Carolina, the most watched regular season college basketball game every year. And then, of course, plays well and plays better and better than we thought, and has jaw-dropping athleticism and continues to improve his game. He's moved himself up to number one on everybody's draft board. And we're left with this unreasonable sense of entitlement from players. Like, look, Zion Williamson is entitled to capitalizing on his success in college in his professional career. That's what everybody does. And no guy is what people will say is, well, he's the poster boy for why you should be able to get money while you're in college. Actually, he's not. Actually, he's the poster boy for what college can do for your name, image, and likeness. Him tied to Duke, tied to jaw-dropping athleticism combined with tearing off a Nike shoe will make him a millionaire 10 times over before he ever steps a foot on an NBA floor. Anyone who wants to argue otherwise, feel free to do so. But in this particular case, you're wrong. Meanwhile, the coaches, like, let's look at the coaches. And whether it's Bruce Pearl, who was successful at Southern Indiana, at UW-Milwaukee, at Tennessee, and now at Auburn, or Tony Bennett, who, of course, was the head coach of Washington State, took them to the Sweet 16. That seems almost impossible now, right? Or whether it's Tom Izzo and his incredible history of success, or Chris Beard, who he's only been a head coach for 4 years, but he's won 30 games twice, once at Arkansas Little Rock. Wow. I mean, there's a reason that these guys are valuable. They employ good people on their staff. They have great foresight in terms of recruiting. It's an actual gift. And they're unbelievable coaches, especially in terms of coaching team play, defensive and offensive cohesiveness. And look, we're a shot here or a shot there from having Kentucky and Duke, two teams loaded up with one and duns or two and duns in the Final Four. So let's not act like this is some, you know, there's a little confirmation bias here. We've always thought older players win. Villanova had older players. They had guys that were drafted in the NBA, but I'm not sure they're superstars in the NBA. But they had the great combination of NBA caliber players that had stayed in school and made themselves into NBA caliber players. So there's some confirmation bias to it, but there's some reality to it. Older guys do win. They do buy in better. They do not have agendas. Their only agenda is to win. And look at Michigan State, a team that lost two lottery picks, that won their tournament in Vegas, Las Vegas Invitational, won the Big Ten tournament, and now has won their regional against Duke, East Regional. Like, they just win every tournament they're in. So that's the overwhelming narrative. I guess Virginia becomes the team to beat because they're the only one seed. They're also champions of the ACC. I would say, doesn't that make Michigan State right there because they're champions of the Big Ten? Something tells me we're going to have a Texas Tech-Virginia national championship game, which will make non-basketball people go, oh, boy. And basketball people go, man, this is amazing. Great defense, great toughness, great tenacity. And then, of course, you have Auburn, who, you know, they lost Mustafa Heron, who transferred and was a super talented player. But and they've, you know, lost players to injuries, but they keep – Bruce can really coach. Jared Harper is tougher than a $2 steak. And, you know, Bryce Brown can shoot the eyes out of it. And they play kind of a unique style. It's a little bit frenetic. And it can rattle some people. And they have guys that are completely bought in. They spread you out. They drive you. I've coached with Bruce a little bit. I can tell you that dude is an awesome coach. Awesome, awesome coach. And he does have this passionate spirit that guys get behind. There's also like four different styles of getting guys to play hard, right? Like you have fire and brimstone and passion and pearl. You have this kind of efficient, steady, steadfast demeanor of Tony Bennett, right? Then you have Tom Izzo, who's fiery and passionate and in your face and kind of a little bit old school, a little bit of a foot thumper, what I used to call, like, there's a guy, Barry Hinson, of course, just retired at Southern Illinois. And I'll never forget, we played against him one of my first games at Oklahoma State, and was he was at Oral Roberts, and we called him Thumper. Coach Hinson knows we called him Thumper because he'd get mad, he'd thump his foot like a rabbit over there. He'd try to yell and thump his foot, and there's a little bit of that with Izzo. And then, you know, conversely, you have Chris Beard, who is an he's a Bob Knight clone in terms of some of his coaching style, but he doesn't MF guys. There's a dry, sarcastic West Texas wit to him. And he can lose his stuff some too, but not really a jacket thrower or a thumper. He's just kind of in between those other guys. And then you have the players, you know, from Ty Jerome, who's unflappable, you know, a guy who never goes by anybody seemingly, but just makes shot over you, to Matt Mooney, who, that kid's a stud, man, from Air Force to South Dakota, now to Texas Tech. I mean, like, you want to talk about a guy who just, like, coaches always says, knows how to play, that's Mooney. Obviously, you got Culliver, who's an elite-level talent, although I think he'll here's what the power of the Final Four, he'll be overdrafted. He's not a great shooter yet. He's playing really the four, whereas he has to be kind of an NBA three. And he's a good, not crazy freak athlete, but again, on this basketball floor, he'll be made to look better. And then you have Cassius Winston, who doesn't really go by anybody his size, but he's just strong enough to push off and get a shot, or just smart enough and quick enough to get by bigger guys. You got the Kenny Goins, who's a former walk-on, whose parents are still paying off the student loan, right? Like, that's crazy. And then you got Auburn. I mentioned Jared Harper and Bryce Brown, who I absolutely love. I don't know. It's going to be a fun Final Four. I don't think it's going to be a huge ratings bonanza. I don't think there's a lot of sex appeal to the style of play or to the names of the coaches or maybe even the names of the players. And it does feel a little bit like, you know, there's a sense, why doesn't college basketball just do the baseball thing? Well, think about college baseball. I love the I love the College World Series in Omaha, Nebraska, and it's a big thing for college baseball, but is it a big thing nationally? Like, kind of feels like that's what we have here. Four great programs, four good coaches, a couple of guys that will play in the NBA, a lot of guys that are borderline, just really good college players. It'll be great basketball, but does it appeal to the mainstream fan? I don't know. Fascinated to see so. You want picks? I don't know. I'm torn on this thing. I think I'm going to go with Virginia. I think I'm going to go with Texas Tech, but, I mean, Michigan State just finds ways to win games, even though they really have one ball handler as their go-to guy. And Auburn's got this unique quality to dial it up, even without Chuma Ukeke, you know, who they've lost now. So I would go with Virginia would be my most confident pick. And then I would say I don't know, on Texas Tech, Michigan State. I'll pick Texas Tech, but there's Michigan State, just that team is tougher than that team is tough as hell. And in spite of the fact they're playing without Langford, in spite of the fact that they have one ball handler, Lawyer doesn't seem, I don't think he can play at this level yet. Cassius just makes enough plays and they put guys in position to succeed. It's pretty amazing. Now let's get to the coaching hires. Buzz Williams goes to Texas A&M, and that's the worst kept secret of all time. Buzz has always tried to get back to the state of Texas. A&M was always seen as a sleeping giant. Remember, there was a time when they had six consecutive teams with Mark Turgeon, I believe, was Gillespie started it, and then Turg took over, and they went to six straight NCAA tournaments, and they had between AC Law and DeAndre Jordan barely played his freshman year, so they'll get credit for DeAndre Jordan, but he didn't do much. Chris Middleton, of course, as well. It feels like still a sleeping giant program. The one difference is if Kelvin stays in Houston, that hurts A&M a little bit. There's a ton of players in Houston, and I still think guys that want to play in the SEC, but SEC basketball does not have the draw of the SEC football. And so Houston being good and dynamic does change it a little bit, but A&M still a big-time job with big-time resources, and Buzz being there, I think kind of sneakily, like, A&M's kind of changed the game there, both football and basketball, with two big-time coaches. And they spent a bunch of money to get them, but they had the facilities, the wherewithal. And the thing about A&M that the challenge is always, okay, you have fan support, you have resource support. You have, even though it's 2 hours or hour and 45, whatever, from Houston, you know, location-wise, Texas, you got players there and kids want to stay in the state of Texas. The what coaches will tell you off microphone, which I can tell you on my podcast, is it can be hard. It used to be traditionally hard to get black kids to go there. It did. And Kevin Sumlin obviously changed it, made it cool to go there. I mean, the swag copter. And so, you know, that's going to be a challenge in football and in basketball. But now Buzz has an appeal to which he's been able to recruit JUCOs and tough kids from any background he seemed to work with at Marquette and at Virginia Tech. So if you can do it there, why can't you do it at Texas A&M? I think it's a very good hire. You know, Buzz has some guys that are detractors. I'm not one of them. I think he's good. I think his team probably could have and should have beaten Duke. I think when you consider how hard it has been to win consistently at Virginia Tech and what he's done, heck, even look at Wojo, who I think does a tremendous job, and how hard it's been for him to transform that program and make it a consistent winner after what Buzz was able to do. Granted, Crean set the stage pretty well for him. There's a creativity in his recruiting. I mean, like, look, Arkansas, they got to be sitting there kicking themselves like, man, we should have gotten Buzz. Then you got Arkansas sitting open, which I still think is a great job. You know, you got, although Memphis is kind of locked down now with Penny. So again, like, kind of like Houston, that like changed the dynamic of that job. But you still have good players in the state. You should be able to get in the DFW when you're in Arkansas. You got good facilities, but it's been a while since Arkansas got it going. And the guy I would hire there would be somebody who wants to get it back to playing kind of more of a frenetic pace, which they tried to do some with Mike Anderson, but I didn't feel like they ever got it. I thought Mike Anderson would work there. Mike Anderson not working and killing it at Arkansas and Joe Scott not working at Princeton. Those are probably the two biggest surprises of my media career in terms of my media career in terms of guys I thought would work that did not work. They just didn't. So, and the big one is if Jamie Dixon, at the time of this recording, it's been reported he's trying to get out of the buyout at TCU. Jamie Dixon to UCLA. Now, full disclosure, I've known Jamie Dixon. Oh my God, I'm getting old. 33 years I've known Jamie Dixon. Like I've known him for that long in some form or fashion, like cross paths with him when he was very early on in his coaching career. So I know Jamie. I like Jamie. And I'm not going to be one of those guys like, I like Jamie and then kill Jamie. No, I like Jamie. It's a weird hire, though. We can admit that. Like, he's boys with Ben Howland. Everybody thought he would get the USC job forever. Then he takes the TCU job where he played. He makes a ton of money. And he did turn around. Like, he got them going. And they've been recruiting well, and he hired a good staff. And that became a great TCU became a great job. Great job. because, you know, again, location-wise, and unlike SMU, they're in the Big 12, and they had the facilities already done. Like, he did a good job. But it's a weird hire because even though he's, you know, he's tied to the Pump Brothers, who, again, I've known from 33 years, who aren't as big of players in the AAU as they used to be, and he's from North Hollywood, and he is an L.A. sort of guy. He hasn't lived there. He hasn't necessarily, I can't remember anybody he signed from Southern California recently. Doesn't mean it won't work, but there's not a certain amount of sex appeal. And if you're going to fire Steve Alford mid-season, you would think if you're UCLA, there would, like, when Kentucky hired John Calipari, go back, pull the tape, everybody that I know, and I said, like, this is a home run. And maybe it's because the home run didn't exist. I don't know. Like, I actually think Shaka would have been, and they were tinkering, kicking the tires with Shaka. Like, Shaka, that style, if Shaka got back to his old style, that could have worked. That could have worked. So I'm fascinated by this entire thing. But it is weird that Jamie Dixon was the name that they felt like settled upon, which is how it generally works, right? Like, you call up John Calipari, you call up Bill Self, you call up Tony Bennett, and you're like, hey, what do you think? And they're like, well, I can't talk to you till the end of the season, but, you know, it's UCLA, I'm interested. And then you have to wait until the season's over, then you call them, and they're like, how much is it? What's the deal? Let me think about it. And then they go back to their AD, and they get bumped up, and then they go, no thanks. I like the idea of Mick Cronin. Just Mick Cronin's hasn't been out in Cincinnati, Murray State, and Louisville. Like, that's his area. He's a tremendous coach, but it would be a little bit fish out of water, whereas Jamie does kind of blend in a little bit better and does have more connections here. It's just interesting to me. I mean, I don't know if there was, with Rick Pitino unhirable, which is he was. He's unhirable. And frankly, with West Coast basketball being seen as being down, you know, Russ Turner, I think, stepped in it, unfortunately, with the king-queen comment, which I think people took way too seriously. And, I mean, it was silly and trash talk and whatever. That's kind of Russ, but he's a great coach. And, I mean, you got no baggage as a human being. Like, I'm surprised Cal didn't hire him, but they went and hired Mark Fox, who, good guy, very good guy, good coach, did an excellent job in Nevada, but did feel like that's not a wow, it's just a solid hire. That's kind of what UCLA did, which is fine. Like, these are good coaches that you'll win games, and they know how to organize a staff, and, you know, they'll be fine. Which I guess maybe is the thought. It's like, hey, look, we can go for the splashy hire, but let's just get a guy that's going to win 25 games a year. And if that's your logic behind it, like, okay. But I'm not sure I fully grasp how the process worked at UCLA. You know, you get this kind of dream team of basketball guys as advisors for Guerrero, and he felt like he settled upon Jamie Dixon. And of course, you couldn't call Jamie Dixon until he lost in the NIT. But I don't know, interesting year where you had coaches get blown out that I didn't see coming in the SEC. Like, I didn't see Bryce Drew getting blown out year three, even though they didn't win a game. And then I didn't see Avery Johnson being let go at Alabama. I did feel like he energized them, and he's a great, I always thought he was a great representative of the university. Like, Avery in room is amazing. And it's like, it's Alabama. Like, you know, hard job. And Arkansas and Mike Anderson, like, I felt like that was fairly quick. He was been there longer than you think. But I'm surprised that he wasn't given an extra year or two, or maybe this was the extra year or two. But the Jamie Dixon one to UCLA, it's like, think about now who's at the big jobs. Okay. Yeah, Bill Self, who's Hall of Fame coach at Kansas. You have Mike Krzyzewski. You have Roy Williams. Indiana, what happens with Arch Miller? Like, I think they'll get that thing figured out. I do think he's a very good coach. We'll see what happens with Arizona. But you got a guy who's won both places that he's been. He does have connections to the area. He's a Scotty Reynolds shot from being in the Final Four. And maybe this is smart in that, like, look, they and forget the noise of L.A. and trying to get the glamour higher. We just got a good coach that does have some L.A. ties. But it's a fascinating process that they went through. All right, before we get to Miles Simon, who's our special guest, he's the MOP. Remember the national championship, the Final Four, they don't do an MVP. They do a most outstanding player. It eliminates the discussion of value. Anyway, before we get to the MOP of the 1997 national championship, we're going to do another longer pod with him, with Miles Simon, who has been my best friend in the sport since we played against each other in fourth grade and then played on the same team as each other since like fifth, starting the next year in fifth grade. It's pretty awesome. But what I want, what he'll do on this pod is he's just going to take us through what he remembers about the NCAA tournament. We'll talk a little bit about Lute Olson as well as that staff. So, all right, let me just say this about the Final Four. It's so incredibly special to me, and this is my pod, and so I'm gonna say some things on it that I haven't ever said publicly before. I may live to regret it, but maybe not. Here's the essence of it. I grew up dreaming of playing in a Final Four and, frankly, covering a Final Four. The street I grew up on was Liberty Way, and there was Constitution and Justice, right? And I remember running down Justice. At the end of the street was a guy named Garrett Phipps, had a flat driveway with a hoop in it. And that's where I honed my basketball skills. Believe it or not, I used to be a great shooter when I was growing up as a kid. And I used to play imaginary games on Garrett Phipps' driveway. And I would announce the games first, like I was, Howard Cosell, or I would try and, you're looking live, and I would try and do a Brent Musburger. So in the things that you should, you know, you should have perspective in life. And though I never accomplished the goal of getting to the Final Four, we got to the Elite Eight in 2000. I did accomplish a goal of covering a Final Four. In reality, I really only covered one. I did a pregame hits for the second year. And it's something I've kind of struggled with, right? When I was at ESPN, I was offered a five-year contract to remain at ESPN. It was a great deal. And it was, you know, financially, the way it works in our business is, or at least it worked at ESPN, was like 6 months before your contract is up, they would tell you, I think they basically went around a room and said thumb up, thumb down, and they would decide if they wanted you back or didn't want you back. And they told us that, yeah, we're going to want to renegotiate with you. We're going to want you back. And so I remember what I was making, and I remember what I thought I would be worth. And I called my then agent at the time, because he called me and he's like, hey, look, they want to engage in negotiations with you, so that's good news. And I was like, cool, here's what I'm worth and here's why I'm worth that much. And he was like, that's a big number. And I said, I got it. I said, you know, here's the percentage of increase it is, but here's how it breaks down. Here's how I believe we'll get to that place. And like in any negotiation, you can only get to a place like that if you have some sort of leverage. And CBS wasn't leverage. At the time, Fox wasn't necessarily leverage. CBS was like, hey, I'd always wanted to cover the tournament. They were launching a radio network. And I didn't know at the time that, you know, they wanted to, you know, give me a TV show. So I remember finally getting the financial offer that I wanted. And it was like maybe 3 months before my contract was up. It was in early summer, and we were going to a concert. I'm going to say like Sarah McLachlan was playing at one of the casinos in Connecticut. And so what we did, I did not go to Sarah McLachlan concert. What I did do was a bunch of couples from the town I lived in, Canton, Connecticut. We all went out to Mystic, Connecticut, this great place to eat. It was like beautiful early summer day. And, you know, we all got babysitters. And then the guys were going to gamble while the women went to the Sarah McLachlan concert. And so we're getting ready. And it's like, I don't know, 5 o'clock on a Friday. And I had taken the day off of radio, or maybe I had filled in for Colin or earlier in the day for somebody else. And I had the afternoon off. And my agent called me and he said, hey, remember the number you told me that you thought you were worth? That's the five-year average of this contract. You hit your number. And I said, that's great. He's like, do you want to take it? I said, well, like, we were still in the process of negotiating with CBS. I said, well, let's see what CBS wants to do. And let's ask ESPN for five things. And I went through what I wanted to do. You know, because, like, they were kind of like, eh, this is tapped out money-wise, which no one's ever... There's no real last and final, but it was kind of a last and final sort of thing. And meanwhile, I hung up the phone and I told my wife, I was like, here's the offer. And she, like, in her head, she was like, okay, so we're staying. I was like, I would guess, yeah. I mean, that's all what I really wanted. You know, I wanted 5 years and I wanted the certain amount. And, you know, I wanted to increase my days off. And so we went to the concert, and we at dinner that night, I just said, like, hey, I know you guys, like, it was a kind of narcissistic moment, but it wasn't. Like, people don't really ask you about your contract, but most of my friends had known that I was in a contract negotiation. And I just said, hey, looks like your guys are going to be stuck with us for another couple of years. I think we're staying. They're like, oh, that's great. We, like, toasted to it. And then I was walking around the casino with one of my buddies. And we were talking about my daughters at the time were young, but had just played their first season of, like, soccer. It was like 3-on-3 soccer. It was in the afternoon. And he had coached, Biskubiak had coached my daughters in the soccer thing. And he's like, man, your daughters are hilarious. It's awesome. He's like, it sucks that you have to miss it. And I started, like, ring around in my head. Like, at the time I was doing 4 to 7 radio on the East Coast. I was getting up doing Sports Center in the morning, which I didn't mind. And then I was doing college basketball for 5 months out of the year, either traveling or doing studio. Again, all of these are things I love, but it took away from my time as a dad in the afternoon and the weekends for 5 months, afternoon for, you know, basically 11 months out of the year. I remember then the next, like, 2 days later, I went up to my son's playroom. At the time, he was like 2 years old, 3 years old, and I kissed him on the forehead, and I walked out of the room, and he said, Daddy, go to work. And I was like, no, dude, I'm just going downstairs to get a drink. And I realized that how often I had gone to work, my son thought that every time I kissed him, it was because I was kissing him goodbye to go to work. And then the last thing that happened, this is in 2012, I had, that year I'd had my boss over, at the time, a guy named Jay Levy, who, if you're a broadcasting guy, somebody should hire him. He was awesome to work for. He just has a great eye for television, knowing what people should and shouldn't say and how to improve people. And I thought he was great to work. He didn't give me everything I wanted, and that's fine. But he always gave me really good advice as a broadcaster. And I remember watching the Final Four and feeling like, at the time, and I still think sometimes I feel this way, that the guys that cover the NCAA tournament, the Final Four, are not guys that are really college basketball guys. And so they're not truly sharing what's special about each player, each team. And maybe people don't care about that stuff. I don't know. And so I thought to myself, I went to my wife. CVS kind of came back with a different offer, and ESPN's offer was kind of like, hey, here's the money. Here's what it is. We're not going to do the other stuff that you asked for with the, you know. So I remember my wife saying to me, like, will you be able to watch the Final Four knowing that could have been you? Because one of the hard things about being an athlete, being a former college basketball player, is watching the Final Four knowing that could have been you. Like, it took, thankfully, 2001, I was overseas. 2002, I was overseas. 2003, I'd covered college basketball for the first time, but then I went back and played in France. I was overseas. And so, yeah, I technically watched the tournament and I followed most of it, but I wasn't here for it. So by 2004, and I was at ESPN, I was covering the NCAA tournament, it had taken that long to actually watch NCAA games, because you're watching thinking, that should have been me. So I remember that feeling, and my wife said, listen, we can stay in Connecticut. We love it here. We had an awesome house, good friends, public schools, safe. She didn't like the weather. It didn't bother me. We did love the idea of California moving close to my folks, I guess on paper. I'm kidding. But ringing in my head was, I didn't play in the Final Four. I get to cover a Final Four. So the Final Four that I was at the desk for was when Louisville beat Michigan. And, of course, if you kind of go back and remember, I remember Syracuse was losing at halftime of the Final Four. And Charles Barkley said, man, Jim Boeheim's got to get out of that zone. And I remember sitting up there looking at Charles Barkley, who, by the way, is like the greatest dude ever, ever. Thoughtful, kind, insightful as a human being as well as a basketball guy. Like, he plays a little bit of a role on TV. Like, this dude is legit. But I remember sitting next to Charles, and I'm like, okay, I can't be that guy that calls Charles Barkley a dumbass. But Charles Barkley would always say, you can call me a dumbass. I don't care. I don't fucking care, right? So the way I worded it was, Chuck, I would get out of the zone. You would get out of the zone. But Syracuse has played zero possessions of man-to-man this season. So the old man on the sidelines, he's not getting out of that zone. And I remember feeling so good about my performance on Saturday. Monday was a little bit of a mess. It was at the old Georgia Dome, and we had audio problems, whatever. And because it was my first year, I didn't get a chance to have my dad come behind the scenes or my family come behind the scenes. And I didn't really push for it. Like, they were like, okay, well, listen, you get these tickets and they're really good seats. And, you know, no one can come kind of backstage in the green room. And I was like, all right. And then I walked back there and everybody else has family and friends back there. And I was like, yeah, it's my first year. I'll be doing this forever. And then the next year I wasn't on the set. Instead, I did pregame stuff and I did a pregame hit on the court. And I predicted Connecticut would beat Kentucky. And that was last year I did it. And then my dad passed away before the next Final Four. And I had a ton of regret. I still have a ton of regret that I didn't have him with me because, you know, it was kind of both of our dream for me to play the Final Four. And then it was my dream to, like, I didn't play, but I wanted him to experience that. You know, he was a college basketball coach that you won 100 games, but completely nondescript. No one would ever know, but just loved ball. That's what the Final Four is about, a lot of things, but it's a celebration of basketball. High school and college coaches from around the country come in and they dream of that. That is their dream. The NBA it's like a completely different element. So now here I am a couple years removed from being part of that CBS crew. And I did the games for 5 years and it was amazing. And now I'm at that opposite point where, it's hard to watch because that used to be me. You know? It used to be me. And, you know, I don't need to bore you with how I think things changed for me and why I've made the decisions that I've made. But I'll just tell you that Final Four can be really hard. It can be really hard. Because it's the goal for so many that so many of us came up short. And though we want to celebrate these kids and these teams and the history of it, and I've been to so many of them, and I've been to over 20 Final Fours. On the other hand, watching it as a player, I thought that should have been me. We had a great team. I thought my last 2 years, really, we were capable. We didn't play. I thought we should have played small ball, and we still could have beaten Auburn in the second round and would have basically taken their one seed. Even as an eight seed, we're preseason top five, top 16. We were good enough. But we didn't have great chemistry for much of the year. And then Joe Atkins, our two guard, wasn't healthy in the NCAA tournament. And then my senior year, you know, we got beat by a Florida team that was young, but super talented, loaded. They had some older pieces too. Mike Miller, Udonis Haslem, Matt Bonner. I mean, dude, they had Justin Hamilton, who was a freshman. Like, they had a squad, but we could have beaten them. And had we had Butler taken a charge, we wouldn't have played them. Or had we taken care of business at other times during the year, we might have gotten a better seed and might have avoided them. But that's not the point. The point is that it's hard sometimes because you think that should have been me. And now watching on broadcast TV, that used to be me. But I'll also tell you this, and we'll get to Miles in a second. It's a long life. Bruce Pearl embodies that, right? Like, I've known BP now for 15 years, and I remember when he was the head coach at UW-Milwaukee, he was incredibly gracious towards my dad, who was a coach at UW-Milwaukee, and he said to me, he said so many nice things to me, he let me coach with him. And, you know, he got fired at Tennessee for, he didn't get fired for the barbecue, he got fired for lying to the NCAA. And, like, look, you lie to your boss, you lie to the NCAA, you're probably going to get fired, and that's what happened. But think about it, he went from there to broadcasting, and as dynamic a personality as he is in life, I mean, he just takes over a room. I never felt like he was super comfortable in broadcasting. Like, he didn't tap into it. They couldn't figure out a way to get that out of him. Maybe he just needed time. Maybe he needed the right co-host with him. I wasn't there. That was right when I left. And I didn't think that he and Greenberg, like, they both have really good energy towards and love and knowledge of the sport. But for whatever reason, it didn't play off each other all that well. There was a weird... Some sort of weird, sometimes, you know, like, sometimes two, you know, like two positive charges don't actually make a positive. But it's a long life. Here he is at Auburn playing for a national championship, you know? And Chris Beard, we've chronicled his career. Think about him. Four years ago, he was coaching at Arkansas Little Rock. Then he takes the UNLV job. Then he's at Texas Tech. Who would have thought they'd play for a national championship the year after losing four starters? It's a long life. It's a very, very long life. And even Tony Bennett, who was at Washington State, and he had a kid named Taylor Rochesty, who my dad, Taylor Rochesty, it was from Santa Barbara, and he wanted to play at UCSB. And Bob Williams at the time offered him as a preferred walk-on. And it's because they had seen him. And, you know, sometimes you see a guy. And Rochester's parents could afford it. He could get into school. And there was a little bit of ego on both sides. And, you know, my dad helped him get on it at Tulane. He was all freshman team in Conference USA. Katrina happened. He wanted to come back to the West Coast. And my dad called Tony and said, I got a point guard for you. And you know what? If push comes to shove, his dad would be willing to pay the fare. And he ended up, you know, tearing up his ACL at Washington State before he ever played a game, but is now, you know, a millionaire playing overseas. And then my dad also recommended they take Clay Thompson. But think about it. Tony Bennett, last year this time, was the first one seed to lose to a 16 seed. And yeah, there was some luck in him, you know, into getting into a Final Four, but here he is. And so, why did I tell the story of me and my professional life? And maybe sometime I'll have a podcast and we'll delve into more like how sports broadcasting on TV actually works and who gets what games and how it actually takes place. Maybe I'll bore you with that. Maybe I won't. But I've called a Final Four. It was amazing. People at CBS were incredible to work with. People at Turner were unbelievable to work with. And it was fun. It hurts when you kind of uproot your life in order to fully invest in something because it's something you've always dreamed of. Like the guy who hired me at CBS, I said, listen, I'm excited to work for you, but just so you know, the holy grail to me is the Final Four. And when he called and told me that I wasn't going to do the Final Four in my third year, although I did other things around the Final Four, I said, I hope you understand what you're taking from me. And he was very matter of fact and very respectful about it. And he said, I understand. I know what it means to you. This is what we've decided. And, you know, continue to just be the professional that you are and do the job that you've always done. It fucking hurts. Just like it hurts all these kids that come up short in the Elite Eight, you know, by a bucket. You know, you don't box out on a free throw and you're at Purdue and now you're not in the Final Four. You know, you're at Kentucky and you have the ball, a chance to win the game in regulation, and now you're on the Final Four. Or you're R.J. Barrett and you're at the free throw line, you miss a free throw, and now you're on the Final Four. And you feel like it's taken from you. But even though those college basketball players didn't accomplish it, and many of them won't play in college again, it's a long life. It's a long life. And I intend to, in some form or fashion, be back. And I'm sure all these coaches will tell you that with every loss, you know, we're going to have Miles Simon. Think about how many times Arizona lost early in the tournament. You know, his freshman year, they lost in the first round. They lost with Damon Stoudemire in the first round to Steve Nash. Like, Arizona used to always lose early in the first round, it seemed like, until they didn't, because it's a long life. So enjoy the Final Four, and I hope you enjoy my dear friend Miles Simon, who joins us now on the All Ball podcast with his memories of the 1997 National Championship run. Okay, so you have this great incoming recruiting class, and you're one of the vets, one of the guys going to be called on. And then you're in preseason, and then you were ineligible the first semester. But when do you, did you know in the summer? Did you know first day of school? Like, how did it actually work? You and I have never discussed this.
So from what I remember is I found out in October that I was going to be suspended because of a class that I withdrew from, I believe, but I withdrew from it too late, and I ended up getting a failing. They changed the grade. I ended up getting a failing grade.
What was the class?
We went through like a whole...
What was the class?
I think it was like college algebra. I honestly can't remember, but I think it was college algebra. And so... We did this like whole appeals process, you know, the athletic department and basketball, whatever. And it went all, I think it went all the way up till like right before the first game. And it didn't go through. And so I was out for the whole semester. So that led us up to the first game against North Carolina, which was this very hyped game.
Yeah.
In Springfield, Massachusetts.
Okay, so, like, did you, like, in practice, were you practicing with the first team? Were you with the second team? Like, what, you know, because it was in flux, what was that like?
I was with the first team all the way, you know, planning on playing, you know, hopefully to play throughout that kind of month time, and then once that happened, then I would just practice with the second team or scout team or whatever for the rest of the semester.
So you guys get ready to go. Did they let you play in the exhibition games?
I don't remember that.
Okay.
So, I don't know.
I mean, I guess the answer would probably be no, right? If you're suspended, those are still exhibition games. So did you?
Yeah, those were ones where we used to play like Marathon Oil.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The other one, I don't remember if I played in them or not.
Okay, so then there's this big game. I don't remember. Did you go? Did you watch it at home? Like, I can't imagine watching it at home, but I also can't imagine watching it in person. And you guys beat North Carolina, who you played later in the NCAA tournament. Did you go to the game?
I did go to the game. I could not travel with the team, so I paid my own way to go to the game, and just sat in the stands. My dad paid for me to go out there. There was still hope. I mean, literally till like the 24th hour, that I might be able to play. I just couldn't go with the team. And so I traveled on my own with the hope that, you know, a last second appeal might go through, and it didn't. And so went to the game, cheered on my teammates. I mean, they had unbelievable performances. Mike Bibby's, you know, first game, Michael Dickerson, I think, had like 30 that night, and we beat Vince Carter, Anton Jameson, Shamon Williams, Ed Cota, Serge Licker, Adamola Okalaja. It was a fun game.
So then you were eligible I think you played, what, right after Christmas? Is that when you got eligible, or did you have to wait till New Year's?
I waited till after New Year's, like when the second semester was starting. So I think we had either played one or two Pac-12 games, Pac-10 games, Pac-10, and so that was when I, so it was after New Year's when I started to play.
And then did you immediately start? Like, did you reassume your role? Well, what's, you know, that's something I've never done before, where you sit and you wait, and you know, you weren't hurt, but the team was. I mean, you guys had some good wins. You'd beaten Utah and Texas and Carolina. You know, and you started off 2-0 in Pac-10 play, Cal and Stanford. So I'm wondering, like, did you right away, like, okay, I'm the guy, or did you have to kind of slowly work yourself in?
No, I had to slowly work myself in. I didn't start. Jason Terry, who started in my place, was having a phenomenal season, and the team was gelling. They were playing phenomenal, and Mike Bibby was coming into his own. Michael Dickerson was, you know, on his way to a great season. So no, I didn't start the first few games back. And I believe we went to ASU, and I think we lost at ASU.
No, you beat ASU. You lost to.
Oh, we beat ASU.
You lost to USC and UCLA.
And UCLA. Yep, we get swept. We get swept on the road. I believe at the LA schools. Mm-hmm. And so the story goes that Jason Terry went into Lute Olson's office and said, "Coach, we're going to be better if Miles starts. I'm willing to come off the bench." But none of us knew that JT had done that. And shortly after that, I get inserted into the starting lineup. We still struggled. You know, we didn't have, like, you know, we didn't just all of a sudden just take off again. It took time to kind of readjust, and I hadn't played, you know, I hadn't played with Mike, and I hadn't played, like, real significant minutes with Jason Terry yet in my career. So it still took some time, and the Pac-10 was deep and tough and hard, and so it took some time, and we were just, you know, kind of a middle-of-the-road team in the league, and evidenced by our record, we were 19-9 going into the NCAA tournament.
All right. So, and remember, and for people who don't remember, that was the Pac-10 had a tournament for, I feel like it was like 5 or 6 years, and nobody cared about it, and all the coaches hated it. And then it went away when you were playing, and still had, they had no Pac-10 tournament. So it wasn't like there was the chance to, you know, win a 20th, 2nd, or 20th, you know, and win a conference tournament champion and figure it out for the tournament started. You played, you know, your last Pac-10 games were at Stanford, at Cal. You lost both of them. So you come in losing two games in a row on the road, and you get a 4 seed, and you're playing in Memphis, Tennessee. Do you remember the South Alabama game at all?
I do. We were down. South Alabama was coached by Bill Musselman. And the things I remember is that they played, like, a really slow and deliberate style. And that they got up on us like double figures in the second half, and we couldn't figure them out. And I remember the point when the game changed is they had been, like, milking the clock, 35 second shot clock back then, I believe. And, like, they would take it to, like, between 6 and 9 seconds, like, nearly every possession, kind of just wearing you down, like a grinded out game. And one guy came down and took a quick three, and, like, early in the clock, and we got the rebound. I think we're down double figures, 7 or 8 minutes left, and we went on, like, a 17-0 run. We went and scored, and then we set up the press, and, like, we got steals, and we sped them up, and then the whole game changed, and obviously we ended up winning that game by, like, 6 or 8 points or whatever it was.
Were you, and again, this is, again, challenging a memory of 21 years ago, you guys were in the same bracket with Maryland. They were the 5 seed, you were the 4 seed, and College of Charleston beat them. Do you remember, was that the game before you or after you? I only asked because I just didn't know if you guys stayed around and watched that game, if that was, do you remember how that worked?
No, I don't remember if they played before or after. I'm going to say we did not stay around to watch, so they must have been before us, because I remember going back to the hotel after the South Alabama game and not staying around and watching. If they were playing next,
what was like Lute Olson like? I know you guys all loved playing for Lute Olson, But I've never, you know, you told me the couple of things I remember you told me is that he basically called no plays, right? He wanted you guys to play free, right?
Yep.
Basically called like no plays. And like you always say, like he's the greatest ever. Like he's the greatest ever. Don't even argue. Like he's the greatest coach ever. And like that, and that's, and then you guys have this all incredible bond as teammates, like the Arizona Mafia thing. You guys are kind of quietly like West Coast Dukies, right? Between broadcasters and coaches and players, like
kind of.
No, I'm serious. It's really interesting to me. Like can't think about this. Kansas and Kentucky, with all their success, like where are their guys that, in terms of running college hoops and running NBA hoops, like they don't exist as much, you know? Whereas Dukies do. Even Carolina Mafia, they do college and pro, but even they, you know, Jordan obviously, but even they don't have nearly the dynamic of the Arizona guys, especially now. So okay, so what is playing for Lute Olson really like?
It's a tremendous thing when you don't know it in the moment. You really know it when you're done there. How special he was as a coach, because he allowed you to be close enough to him to where, like, you could go to him with anything, but where he was still kind of the authoritative figurehead or coach or whatever, where he could be stern with you and coach you and teach you, you know, hopefully, you know, like life lessons And the way that he coached you, you know, Coach Olson doesn't say he doesn't say curse words, but you still felt like his wrath or his ire, because he's such an imposing figure, because he's like 6'5". He has these huge hands, and he has this presence when he walks in a room, like, you know, he's there, and he commands like attention. But then he just gave you so much freedom on the court, man. We literally ran motion offense, which is something I did in high school. And I've talked to Damon Stoudemire about this because playbooks now, even in college, the coaches have so many plays. They run plays, and it's always like, I feel like teams are so robotic at all times. Doug, we literally had five plays, and the names of the plays were 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And then I think we had two zone plays. And that was it. And then you just hooped. You ran three out, two in, motion offense, you cut, you pass, you screen away. You just learned to play basketball, and then you try to play up tempo. And that was the type of freedom that he gave you. And that was awesome. And I remember my friend Donnie Daniels, who was a coach at Utah at the time. And it was Donnie Daniels and maybe Lorenzo Romar. Both told me, they said, we were always the hardest team to scout, because when you ran motion offense...
Yeah, you can't scout it.
You can't scout it, because you can't tell your team, oh, Miles is going to be in this spot on this play, or every time down, or every other time down, or Mike Bibby's going to be here, because it was random. We read what the defense was doing to determine what we were going to do.
Then in practice, would you practice reading screens? Would you practice motion? Like, what was the, how did they teach you how to play? Or was it like you'd play and he'd stop it and show you what you want to do?
I think it was different for everybody. I have a pretty good feel for the game. So, like, for me, I kind of knew how to read screens and play. We played a lot of, like, 2-on-2 or 3-on-3 for the guards, just kind of breaking your guy down, getting in the paint, penetrating, kicking. Then you might add a big guy into the mix so he could screen from you. But coach was big on scrimmaging every day, like a lot of competition in practice. And it was never, besides when you were doing scout team work, scrimmages were always like mixed. So he never wanted like all the top guys going against, you know, the next, you know, the 6 through 10 guys. So I always either had to guard Mike Bibby, Jason Terry, and Michael Dickerson every day. And I think that's also what made us better, because we had to compete against each other. But literally just playing is kind of how we learned motion offense, how to read screens. And of course, yeah, they would stop it in practice. Like, hey, he cut the screen here. You probably should have flared to the corner, or he's trailing on the screen, that should have been a curl cut, you know, instead of just popping out to the wing. So, yeah, of course, they would teach on that, but playing was just a big part of it.
Fascinating. It really is interesting because was it your freshman year you guys lost to Santa Clara in the first round of the tournament?
No, Miami of Ohio. That was Damon Stoudemire that lost to Santa Clara. We lost to Miami of Ohio with Devin Davis, and I believe Herb Sendek was the coach.
That wasn't a Wally Zerbiak team, was it? That was Devin Davis?
Devin Davis, yep.
Yeah, there's another guy, Ira Bowman, I played with, who played at Miami of Ohio, that was a stud, played a little bit in the NBA. Okay, so, it's fascinating to me. Okay, so then you win that game and you play College of Charleston, but that game was close too, right? Were you trailing in that one as well?
Yeah, I think it was just a back-and-forth game, and College of Charleston was super underrated team. Anthony Johnson, longtime pro.
Yeah.
Thaddeus Delaney, who was a monster in the post at the time. And they had the longest winning streak in the country going into the NCAA tournament, like 20 some odd games in a row. Even though Kansas had only the one loss, they had lost in conference play to Missouri that year. So College of Charleston was a super challenging team. We didn't win a game in the NCAA tournament by more than 8 points. Yeah. And I don't know how much we won that one by, but very difficult game. That team was fired up to play us. Obviously, they were a very, very good team. But I just remember it kind of being a back and forth game, all the way till the last few minutes.
Okay. You're the staff at the time, right? Was who? Rosenblum was
Jim.
Go ahead.
Jim Rosborough,
Jesse
Evans, and Phil Johnson were our assistant coaches.
Okay, so what was the dynamic like of the staff? Like you have Lute, right? And you made him now. Like, was he when he get on you? What would he get on you about? Like you made
turnovers mostly. You know, Miles, you have more turnovers than a bakery. That was like one of his classic lines. I think mostly just turnovers, because for me personally, I didn't have a problem like playing hard or competing every day in practice. Maybe if you felt I wasn't playing tough, you know. But those were probably the things. Those were probably the main things that he would get on me about or most guys.
Okay, so give me the staff role kind of breakdown, right? Because so when I'm at Oklahoma State, for example, you know, Coach Sutton was, I mean, he was hard on you now. I mean, he was on everybody, and he kind of same thing where he had a presence. We didn't really run emotion. We ran a little bit of emotion, but it was like, honest to God, they would never teach it. It was like, what do you want to do? We go here, like, you know, you just play basketball. And, I mean, it was so, so different. You're like, well, do you want me to, and what we would do is we had a secondary break. We ran Kansas' secondary break, which is the Carolina breaks, into like a half court set, which is really like just an entry into some sort of passing game. And then we'd run like 15 second. We'd either run like an ISO or a high ball screen, whatever, but we'd always have that called. And then we'd switch the calls at every free throw. Like, you had the free throw line, and we're on defense, and we'd gather up, and then we'd change the calls. Like, all right, our 15-second play is we're going to do, you know, single-double, or I don't know, you know, or we'll, you know, double. But basically, that's what we did. So it looked kind of free-flowing at everything, but it was really all choreographed. So we had Sean Sutton called and drew up almost all the plays. Coach would occasionally call him, and I think he knew him, but I'm not totally sure he knew all the plays. And then we had Paul Graham was like recruiting and would just yell at you to, y'all ain't playing hard. Shit. Y'all ain't, you know, like that's literally all he did. And then we had Randall Dickey, who was like a longtime assistant, a JUCO guy. And he was just like, he was everybody's like favorite. Like, oh, y'all great, man. Y'all doing all right, man. Y'all got to keep playing hard now. Right. So, okay. So give me the breakdown of your staff.
Well, first, now that you bring up the name Paul Graham, can I share Paul Graham's story?
Yeah, go,
quick?
go. The judge. His nickname, by the way, is the judge. The judge.
Because you know, Oklahoma State was one of my final four schools, right?
So I know this story, but I don't think America knows the story. I definitely don't think Oklahoma State fans know the story.
Yeah, so Oklahoma State, Arizona, Florida, Syracuse, like, were my final four. And, you know, at that time in recruiting, going into my senior year, like, you could call a kid, I think, once you get in contact, like, going into your senior year, maybe, like, twice a week, you could talk to them on the phone. There weren't any cell phones, so they were only calling the landlines. And so in the month of August was a time to really call. It was, a dead time. There's no AAU. School's not going on. But Paul Graham, he's doing his job, but to get a hold of someone, you got to call at like some different hours to make sure the kid is home, right? So he would be calling from Oklahoma, which is obviously 2 hours ahead, but he would be call at like 7 a.m. in California time in August, which is a total downtime for me, and I'm not awake at 7 a.m. in the summertime as a 17-year-old kid. And so my grandmother would answer the phone. And she would come upstairs and she would be like, Miles, it's that coach from Oklahoma State again. Do you want to talk to him? No, I'm not going to talk to him at 7 a.m. I mean, like literally every day, Paul Graham would call and I would never take, I wouldn't take the call at 7 a.m. Like, but he never stopped calling at 7 a.m. He didn't like figure that out, but that was my Paul Graham story. And obviously didn't end up going to Oklahoma State.
Did you visit there?
I did not visit. I visited Florida with Lon Kruger. Had a great time. They had the meat hook at the time. Andrew DeClercq, Craig Brown. That team went to the Final Four my senior year of high school, and that was the only other visit I took there in Arizona.
And what I remember you told me about that one because at the time they had an assistant that was out there out recruiting both of us, right? And
yeah.
Do you remember how that all went down? Like you had a great time, and then you got on the plane to come home, and you're like, "Damn, it's too far. I can't do it."
It was too far. Yep, that was pretty much exactly. I wanted my family to see me play a lot more, and it was just too far to go to Gainesville. It was just too far.
Yeah,
and that was pretty much it. And then that kind of solidified that I knew I probably wanted to go to Arizona, and I actually committed to Arizona sight unseen. I came home from the Florida trip, went into my high school coach Gary McKnight's office at Mater Dei, and I said, I want to commit to Arizona. And he's like, you sure? And I was like, yeah. And so, like, we called Coach Olson, and I was supposed to go to Syracuse the next weekend. And so I called all the schools. Like, Bernie Fine was the one recruiting me for Syracuse. Called them, and they were like, are you sure you don't want to come? You should come on the visit, come and see it. And I'm a person that just kind of knows what I want and what I like, and what feels like good or perfect to me. And so just went with my gut and my heart and took my trip to Arizona like 2 or 3 weeks later. And then, the rest is history.
Hmm. Yeah. I just, so you know, you ruined it for me at Florida. I was super in on Florida. Florida and Virginia were like the first two big schools to offer me. And I think like one of the reasons like Florida was like, it was because they just assumed I would take them, you know, take them up to the altar and then say it was too far. Right. And I went to that Final Four in 1994 and, obviously, you know, my dad coached Lon in college. And so that was a fun team to watch.
It was a fun team to watch.
But didn't like,
Andrew Clerk was like Andrew DeClercq was one of the first ones to do like chase down block.
Yeah, he did chase down block, and he would hit the ball up, right? Like I remember him chase down block, and he would hit it up even after it hit off the backboard and wasn't a goaltend.
Yeah, he was amazing at that. So back to your original question, you asked the staff dynamic. Yeah. One thing I loved about Coach Olson, as a head coach that I came to find out when I worked under him, is that he lets all his coaches coach because he wants them to be head coaches. And so, like, everybody had input just about the stuff that they did in practice, the scouting reports, being able to, you know, correct players during practice. And I thought that was a great thing. And he shared a line when I was on staff at Arizona one time in our coaches meeting and I was just a young coach. I think I was in my first year. He just said, eight eyes are better than two. So obviously you only have three assistants in college and then the one head coach. He goes, I can't see everything that goes on, you know, always. He goes, so I need you. And he was talking to Josh Pastner and myself. He's like, I need you guys to be more vocal and correct these guys and coach these guys. And he's, eight eyes is better than two. And I always love that line that he shared.
Okay. So you get back from playing in Memphis and, so now you're in the Sweet 16 and now all of a sudden you're getting ready to play Kansas, right? Like you played Kansas in the Sweet 16, I believe.
Yep.
And Kansas had Rafe. They had Jock, right? And for people who don't, remember, like Vital used to love Jock Vaughn. I mean, people think, I used to love Jock Vaughn. Like he was older than us. My freshman year in high school, we eliminated Muir, like his high school, John Muir from the playoffs. And we basically ran a 1-3-1 and just like corralled him, like trapped him every time he got it. And even though he couldn't shoot, it didn't matter. Like he was just a masterful point guard without a jumper. Who else did they have?
Yep. Paul Pierce. Scott Pollard and Jared Haas. That was their starting five.
Man, that's
they had a squad. They had a squad.
I played with Jared Haas. Do you remember the Superstars Camp? Did you ever go to that?
No, I never went to it, but I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, so I had my power. I was a rising freshman, and I got to play in Superstars Camp. Jared Haas was the other guard. Was another guard on my team, and then Willie McGinnis was our big guy, and everybody in camp was scared of Willie McGinnis. Rightfully so. And it was awesome, right? Like, he'd set a ball screen, and guys would do everything in their power to get the hell away from Willie,
of course.
Willie McGinnis. So he went to, people forget, he went to Cal first and then transferred. Yep. So he's older. Paul was young. Pollard was old. Rafe was probably a junior.
Rafe was a junior.
Junior, yep. Yeah.
Pierce was a sophomore.
Yeah, I mean, this is a stud team. Okay, so what do you remember about the Kansas game?
I remember getting to Birmingham and
You guys went Memphis to Birmingham? Did you go home?
No, we went home. We went home, but I remember, you know, when we went back to Birmingham, a few things about that. So, like, you know, myself, I'm a big sneaker guy, along with Mike Bibby and the rest of our team, Arizona teams and, like, UConn, you know, a few other schools. Michigan are always known as some of the teams with, like, always the freshest shoes. And so our Nike rep brings these blue shoes to Birmingham. And what is now one of the most famous Nike shoes of all time is the Penny Foamposites. And we were the first team to get them. And so we get them. We're having practice in Birmingham. Everybody's wearing them. We're like, what are these? Because it's like this like revolutionary thing for Nike. These foam pods, these shoes that are foam on the outside or whatever they're made of. And so I'm wearing them in practice. But one thing, like when I hoop, like I got to have shoes with good grip. Like I can't slip. I plant hard.
Yeah, yeah, no, I got you. Yeah.
I plant hard. I cut hard. So I'm wearing these shoes, but I'm like slipping on the court. And I was like, man, I told Mike, I ain't wearing these. I'm not wearing these in the game. I was like, I can't do it. They're too slippery. And Mike Bibby was like, shit. He's like, fuck that. He's like, these shoes are nice. He goes, I'm wearing them no matter what. And so, this would have been in March, obviously. These shoes were meant for Penny in the playoffs in 97. But we wore them before Penny did, but they helped obviously because we won the title and Mike Bibby was wearing them during the NCAA tournament. It helped to project like this thing for the shoes going forward when Penny was going to debut them in the playoffs.
I thought they were heavy.
So that was the first.
I thought they were heavy. That's what I remember.
Yeah, I didn't like them. I never wore them in a game. I never even wore them after that. But I just had them for a long time.
Yeah, that's the secret though. One of the secrets of the NCAA tournament, especially, and you can speak to this in the Final Four. Whereas Nike always got out their next generation of shoes in the Final Four, and you and I going to all those Final Fours, we used to watch like oh, check out those sneakers, check out those kicks. Those are. So what did you wear?
I wore Air Max Uptempos, all black, and that was like they're one of the most comfortable basketball shoes I ever played in. I still have them in my house to this day. Those shoes, I wore those the black Air Max Uptempos from the Sweet 16 all the way through the championship, and I still have the original pair. I have them sitting in my house in the closet right now to this day.
All right. So go ahead.
So that was the first memory. Then the second was on the day of the game. I believe the headline in the Birmingham paper, because we still read newspapers back then, was Kansas and the others, because it was us who had nine losses and finished fifth in the Pac-10, and then it was Tennessee, Chattanooga, and it was Providence. So everybody thought just Kansas was going to roll to the Final Four. And I still remember. I just remember that headline because I felt it was like so disrespectful. Our team had utmost confidence in ourselves that we could not only play with Kansas, but beat Kansas. And like the way we looked at it, and most players, maybe they do that. I don't know, but I was like, man for man, I felt like our team was better. Like Mike Bibby better than Jock Vaughn, me better than Jared Haas, Michael Dickerson at that time. Better than Paul Pierce, and that's just the way I envisioned as a 21-year-old, and that I felt like our inside guys, I was like, you know, Scott Pollard, Rafael Frenz, I was like, okay, I'll take my dudes over them any day of the week, you know, and so that's the way we approached it, and I mean, we went out, and I think we really caught Kansas off guard with our speed, how hard we play, and how good we were, and we jumped on them, man. They had to make a late run to just even. Obviously, the game ended up being a three-point game, but we were up like 15, 16 points in the second half.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. We played against that team the next year, but not that year. But one of the things that happens, though, when you pull – a lot of times you guys pull up – teams pull off that upset is you do kind of exhale, and sometimes that and because you pulled off the upset of the tournament – you know, in some people's mind in the Sweet 16, like there's so much attention and you got the media and like, hey, dude, there's still another game to play, right, to get to the Final Four. Do you remember what it was like after the game?
Yeah, we were, immediately after the game, like obviously celebration, like going crazy, excitement in the locker room. But we knew that like that wasn't our goal to just beat Kansas. Like we were a focused group and we knew we could win it. We knew we could win it all. So like our focus level and our concentration, like it never waned. Like, okay, let's get ready for Providence. You know, it's not going to be an easy game, by any means, with Austin Crozier and, God Sham God and, Ruben Garces. So we were focused and ready to prepare for the next one. Like we weren't overlooking, either, you know, weren't overlooking Providence all the way to the Final Four already.
They had a stacked roster. I played against that team the year before, and they weren't very good record-wise, but they were hard to play against because they started playing small, right? I think they played like Garces at the five and Austin at the four, if I remember. And they would just like, they were like one of the first teams to space everybody out. And then because God couldn't shoot, but you couldn't keep him in front of you, they would just spread you out. They also had, didn't they have Jamel Thomas as well?
Jamel Thomas, and I believe John Linehan.
Derrick Brown was the other. They had a kid named Derrick Brown who averaged like 17 a game in 97. So anyway, so it's, yes, Ruben Garces, God Sham God, Jamel Thomas, Derrick Brown, and Austin Crozier. Austin and Derrick Brown averaged, you know, 17 and a half a game apiece. But also, like, your guys, you guys overwhelm people with your speed and athleticism, and that was kind of an equal match for you speed-wise, weren't they?
Yeah, they were, and they were, like, physically tough, and same thing kind of happened in that game as the Kansas game. We were up big in the second half, and it was like a little bit of a learning lesson. In the NCAA tournament, it's such a fine line of, like, okay, there's, like, 4 or 5 minutes left, and you're up double figures. Do you milk the clock? Do you keep, when you have like open shots within the first 7 or 8 seconds, do you take it? Do you pull back? And I think we started like pulling back, like letting off the gas pedal a little bit, and we would miss, they would score. We actually fouled Crozier out. So Garces was in there. I think he had like 19 rebounds that day. Then they would like go to they were going to the foul line, and Garces would, they would miss, and Garces would get an offensive rebound, and then they would get like 3 points instead of two. And so they were just like slowly but surely just cutting into the lead, cutting into the lead. And then like we were playing, then we started playing a little bit more tight, and not taking shots and like turning the ball over. And then all of a sudden we found ourselves in a game, and they actually had the last shot to win the game. We blow the whole lead, and everything is like going wrong, and they get like this baseline out of bounds, and I forget who takes it. I might have been Linehan that it goes to on the like 17 or 18 foot jumper, and like it wasn't close, and then we are able to hang on in overtime.
So you're going to the Final Four, and for some people, anybody going to the Final Four is a big thing, right? Like, I didn't go, and I remember it was just way more devastating than losing in any other round of the NCAA tournament. But for us, for you and me, like, this is what we've done. Like, our whole lives as kids was, I want to play in the Final Four, because we would go as fans, and you, me, Clay McKnight, whatever, and we'd go, you know, I remember playing video games with Cherokee Parks in 94, right before they're getting ready to play the championship game. And there's so many different memories, like going to Minneapolis this year. I was there. I remember being there when Duke, I was selling tickets out front, and then went in and would sneak down low when Duke won. I remember when Seton Hall beat Michigan. You and I were hanging out, I don't even remember this one, with Bill Walton, because Adam Walton was on our team, and like he was getting us like into the arena, backstage and everything. Like, so the Final Four, what was it like to go, like, we'll get to when you won the championship. When you're just like, I'm going to the Final Four, what was that like?
Man, for me, unreal experience, because that's all, you hit on so many points. My dad had taken me, and you and I had experienced Final Fours together, but I had been to like 8 Final Fours as a kid. That was like my dream, to play in the Final Four. And to like actually get there as a player was really surreal. And, you know, couldn't wait to get to Indy. We had, going back to Tucson, we had this huge reception in McHale Center when we qualified for the Final Four. And like it was just amazing. Like, I couldn't wait to get to Indianapolis and like just to get rolling. Like, the week actually moved like super slow. Like, we qualified, we were the last team into the Final Four. So like Sunday, but like the next Saturday couldn't come quickly enough.
All right. So it's in Indy. You guys roll into town, and the practices aren't as big now as they were then. Like, back then there used to be 40,000 people at practices, and, there's a bunch of different kind of interesting parts to it. People forget Minnesota was there. Minnesota was loaded with Bobby Jackson and what was the kid's name? Jacobson, who people thought he was Jewish, but he's not. They called him the Jewish Jordan. He was not. Carolina was there, who you guys had beaten, but you didn't play in that game. And of course, Kentucky was there. What do you remember about practice at the Final Four?
Not much, actually. Just, you had the hour. We went in, just shot around, getting used to playing in a dome is different, just because of the depth perception. And you know, like now how they do the Final Four so they can get more people, they open it up. But back then it was the RCA dome. They cut off one side of the stadium, and then they bring in stands on one side, and then they put you closer to the court is just on one side of the dome. But just getting used to the dome. It's like an hour practice, and coach, you just go out, you know, do some 5-on-0, 3-man weave, and then shoot and dunk and get the crowd hype, and then get out of there. Then you have your real practice at a local. Ours was at a local high school, and that was the time to like really get locked in on the scouting report and all those things.
All right. So, what was the Carolina game like?
It was an amazing game, because they blitzed us from the start. You know, they jumped out 15-4, I believe was the score. And like Vince Carter had like these three like amazing dunks. He like catches a lob. He like reverses on us, and then like another one in traffic or something like that. And we were like playing either tight or scared or nervous. But they're kind of playing with a chip on their shoulder because they had been one of the top two or three teams all season long, and we had obviously beaten them. And so I remember Coach, I think he called a timeout. I just remember in the timeout, I told our guys, we were down 15-4, and I said, just give me the motherfucking ball. Give me the motherfucking ball. And then I think like the next possession, I hit like a deep three, and then maybe score, and then all of a sudden the momentum and the tide started to turn. And we like ended up taking control of the game, and you know, we ended up winning by 8 points, and we did a really good job. Still low scoring game. I think it was 66-58. So the pace of the game kind of slowed down in that one. But you know, you just remember there being like a sea of blue because of Carolina and Kentucky there, all blue. And then our fans in the red, obviously, in the dome for the semis.
You win. So, and then I just remember you hitting people with the up and under in your mid range game, right? That was right. That was the signature part was the wink to everybody remembers you winking at the camera in the championship. And Simon says a championship, which is really good from Jim, really well done by Jim Nance. And then of course I remember the mid range game. So you beat Carolina, like, dude, you just beat Carolina a second time. You're playing for a national championship. What do you do on that Sunday before? Like, you have practice, right? And you have media stuff, and you just kind of sit around. I remember seeing you after the championship game, but I don't remember where you were that day.
Yeah, so day between games, hang at the hotel, light practice, and for me, a lot of video games in the room. Like, my roommate was Justin Wessel. We just, like, put on the PlayStation and played video games. And another fascinating story, little story, side note is we had at that time, you remember the show Family Matters?
Yep.
Okay. And who was the star of that show?
Urkel.
Urkel was a big fan of, like, Lute Olson. And they became friends somehow. And so, like, so Jaleel White, Urkel at the time, one of the most famous TV stars in America, was like hanging at our hotel, and specifically came to my room and was playing video games with like me and Mike Bibby and my roommate Justin Wessel, and then he came to like one of our team meals during the week. So I don't even know why or how that happened. I've never really asked, but yeah, Jaleel White, Urkel was hanging with us. But the off day was just like really relaxed, kind of chill, just kind of mostly just stay up in the room and prepare. It seemed like an eternity to the championship game also, because I believe like the title game tipped off at 8:30 at night.
Yeah.
You know, maybe 9 o'clock, some like ridiculously late time. And so like, so that time from playing on Saturday till the national title game, you just kind of antsy and anxious, just waiting to get back out there.
All right. So take the floor. There's Kentucky. And the one thing that's interesting about Kentucky, they were stacked, but AU basketball has changed a lot since then. Like, now it does feel like there's like a group of dudes, and regardless of shoe company, whatever, like you play against you. Most everybody knows most everybody, right? Like, when you play against a guy in college, like, you've seen him. I remember there were certain teams in certain parts of the country where you'd run into dudes like, it's like the Providence thing. Like, Austin, we knew because he grew up in Southern California, but I think God played with the Gauchos, right? And they would play. They would play. They would play in Vegas, and they would always lose an early game in Vegas too, right? Like, you always want to play Gauchos in Vegas. But there's a lot of guys that were, they're super East Coast guys. You'd never see them until you played them on a college floor. Did you know the Kentucky guys?
Not really. Maybe Ron Mercer a little bit because he had a lot of high school fame. But no, I didn't really know the other guys. I didn't know Wayne Turner, Jamal McGlure, Nazi Muhammad, Scott Pageant. Only from watching them when they were on TV. That was it. No, I didn't know them. You just didn't. Like, you might have read their names in Street and Smith or like Sporting News, and that was it at the and that was it at the time.
You know, it's so funny. It's like we don't give kids like today credit. Like, they do read. You know, they'll read like online rankings and publications stuff. But like you and I, like, we used to pick up all that stuff, and we're hoop guys, right? Like, you pick up a magazine and you read it, you read about guys, and that's just kind of how you. I do wonder if there are guys other than the rankings, if they read as much and know as much about the sport as we did. I'm sure there's guys like that, but I don't know if they were great players like you were that were as invested in the sport. Okay, so you play Kentucky. What do you remember about the game?
I remember Kentucky was a pressing team. One, they had won the title the year before with Antoine Walker and some of these guys that had returned. Antoine Walker, Tony Delk were, I think, a couple of Walter McCarty, some of the main stars. But I remember, you know, Pitino just, you know, putting this pressing style into the game. And so I remember we practiced. Almost our whole practice was focused on just our press break. That if we could break a press, handle their pressure, to attack the pressure and try to get, you know, layups against it. That was our ideal plan. And then when the game starts, and I don't know if this was normal or abnormal for their team, they didn't press. They didn't press to start the game. And I thought to myself, they're scared. Or they were nervous. They didn't want to, with myself, Jason Terry, when he came in the game, Michael Dickerson, that they didn't want to get their press broken down and give up layups to us. And I felt like, okay, well, that gave me a little bit more confidence that maybe they're a little bit nervous or they're worried about us, you know, more so than anything. And so, like, that game, I just remember it being back and forth, no team leading by more than 5 or 6 points throughout the game, because there was so much talent, a lot of toughness on the floor. And then looking back on that game, I remember I had 30 in the national title game, but I didn't make a three, which, like, for a guard, like, nowadays, if you think about that, like, how's a guy going to score 30 without making threes? You know, I went to the line like 17 times that game. So just like super intense, tough, like, hard-fought game. Like, nothing really came easy.
When did you know you had it won?
when the buzzer sounded. I mean, I think we're up three. Anthony Epps hits, like, an incredible three to help late in the game to, like, send it to overtime. And then our defense just kind of locked in overtime. I remember during the huddle between regulation and overtime, like I said earlier in the podcast, like, we only had five plays. So, like, Coach Olson wasn't going to, like, he's never taking the whiteboard and drawing up a play to, like, open up the overtime period. And all he said to our group was, the toughest team is going to win. And I think we truly believed we were the tougher, better team. And our defense locked in that overtime period. And they had trouble scoring. We only made free throws in overtime. We didn't make a field goal. I think we scored 10 free throws. And then that was it. So I didn't feel we had it in hand until until the buzzer went off.
And then what's that like?
Exhilarating, exciting, a surreal, just like you can't believe that it actually happened moment. You know, still kind of gives me chills. Not kind of, it does give me chills to this day, thinking about it, because it's a hard thing to do. And I think our run is one of the most underrated that's ever happened. We are the only team in the history of the NCAA to beat three number one seeds. And they were the three winningest college programs of all time.
Yeah.
And it's, I think it actually doesn't get talked about enough, with what we did.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, Auburn obviously has beaten Carolina, Kentucky, and Kansas. Kansas wasn't the same, this year. But it's one of the reasons it makes the total sense that to have you on, but people forget that those are 3-1 seeds. And, you know, now obviously Auburn will get a chance at another one seed when they play, Virginia, in the Final Four. They won't, I don't think, who's the other ones? And they won't play another. So they can't beat a third one seed because they can't do it. Right. They can't do it, but they will have. Okay. So you win. Had you cut down a net before? You guys won CIF, right? So you didn't win. I don't remember you winning state, but I remember you guys.
We didn't win state. We won CIF 3 times. Yeah.
So had you, when you won CIF, you guys cut down nets or no?
No, I don't think we did. We did. We cut down a net before. Yeah, in high school.
Okay, I'd never cut down a net before. Do you remember that? Do you remember like what post game? What post game is like? Okay, this I remember.
Post game was fun. Bennett Davison messing up the impeccable Lute Olson's hair, yeah, which never had a hair out of place, it seemed like, in his life. And that was it was typical, like Bennett Davison is like the goofiest, funniest guy that you could ever be around and like the most loose person. And you feel like Coach Olson is like this like tense, presidential figure, and Bennett goes and messes up his hair, in Lute Olson's biggest moment as a coach, you know, like, and he's going to go like do like post game interviews. I remember I kept the ball in my hands. I kept it for as long as I could, actually. And I took it back to the hotel that night, kept it in my room, brought it on the plane. Cause I wanted to keep the ball. I wanted to have the ball. And we get on the plane to come back to Tucson the next morning. And Coach Olson asked, where's the ball? And everybody's like, oh, Miles has it. I'm like, damn, guys. You know, kind of told me. And then I gave it, Coach has the ball. So Coach has the ball. Cutting down the net was awesome. Still have the net. Still have pieces of the net. And then, so in downtown Indy, they have a restaurant called Steak and Shake.
Yep.
And so, like I said earlier, the game started real late. You know, it lasts 2 hours, 45 minutes, maybe longer because of overtime, TV timeouts, all that stuff. Post-game interviews, like, you're not leaving the arena till 1:30, something like that. Get back to the hotel, like, then there's, like, another celebration with the fans, like, because they're all in there. So it was, like, just craziness, just, like, nonstop. And it's still, like, it's, like, 2 in the morning, 2:30. Then now I'm getting like hungry. I don't think there's like no post game food. So we grab a bunch of teammates and, trying to go find some food. And we found this, we walk out of the hotel and we go to Steak and Shake, a 24-hour spot. And the place is like packed with fans and, walk in there and like our team gets like a standing ovation in there and people are chanting MVP, MVP. And that was at like probably 3-something, 4 in the morning now, in Indianapolis. And so those are probably the things that stood out the most. It was just like, an unbelievable thing, unbelievable ride.
Okay. So now, I'm trying to think here what else I want to get to. So we're 22 years removed from it. Damn, 22 years removed from it. This is a hard question. Okay. You decided to come back the next year, and I want to do kind of a mm-hmm. longer form, and we'll do this again. We'll talk more about coming back, but just in the right now in your mind, how vivid is the memory of losing the next year in Anaheim as opposed to winning in Indy? Like, I've always wondered that. Like, does losing hurt more than winning feels good, or does winning just overwhelm all the other feelings?
That's a tough one, actually, just because of the scenario. This one, winning trumps losing, because we did win the national title, and that is so big. But as you know, like Doug, you know me since we were 12 years old. I hate losing more than anything. And the way we went out in that last game, I mean, Utah beat the brakes off of us by 20 some points. Andre Miller had a triple double in the lead eight. They played a triangle in two, that we never saw. And that game stung. In this case though, the winning, those thoughts, those feelings, those memories override losing in that last game and against Utah and Anaheim.
Will there ever be another team with as many halfies as you guys had at Arizona?
Oh man, we had a lot of me, Mike Bibby, AJ Bramlett, Donnell Harris, Bennett Davis. We had five, four of them in the starting lineup.
That's like the all-time mixed race team. All-timer.
Pretty much.
Yeah, right? The only thing, I've wondered, you know, now kids are doing a lot of more hyphenated names. I do wonder when we're going to get a third name in there, right? Like, or a double hyphenated name, right? Like a double hyphenated, it's like the perfect multicultural. But you guys, that was kind of your thing. I remember you telling me, like, that we got the best halfies on earth. Like, we are team happy.
We are definitely that, and we definitely talked about it.
Yeah,
there probably will be at some point.
Pastner, you give Pastner a lot of love, but I do remember, I distinctly remember right after you won a championship, Pastner was right in front of the camera, and then you guys shoved him out of the way. There had to be a little bit of like, dude, your sneakers didn't even squeak back then, wasn't there?
Josh loved the camera back then, man. He was always looking for FaceTime. He always knew where the cameras were. he's just such a happy-go-lucky dude. It became like a running joke. Like, man, you know, get your face out of there, man. Like, get your face out of there. And like everybody just pushing him away, cause he was the walk on and never played. But he took it all in stride. He didn't care. He thought it was funny. We thought it was funny. It was just a hilarious thing.
To this day, how many times a day do people recognize you for winning a national championship?
Times a day?
Yep.
Not very many. It also probably just depends on where I'm at. Yep. Like if I'm in Orange County and I'm just walking around, nobody. But if I'm in, like, I don't know, Tucson, or if I'm at one of our Lakers games at the arena, you know, someone might bring it up. But not that often.
All right, man. Listen, I know you got a busy, super busy schedule. I wanted to recap that with you for this pod. We'll do another one in terms of the life and times and what this journey's been like for you. I really appreciate you sharing your story with me.
No problem, man. Appreciate you having me on.
That's going to do it for this week's All Ball. Make sure you download the Doug Gottlieb Show. Our daily podcast is available at foxsportsradio.com or on iTunes. It's also on air every day, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio, the iHeartRadio app. We have two different stations, 203 and 217, I think, XM and Sirius. Those are the channels. You can listen to us daily. At Gottlieb Show is, in fact, the Twitter handle. In the meantime, continue to tell friends about this. We'll transition to NBA. We'll tell college basketball stories. We'll break down NBA draft picks. And, of course, next week we'll join you and talk about who wins a championship. I'm going to take Texas Tech. I'm going to take Virginia. I feel a little bit better about Virginia than I do the Texas Tech pick because Michigan State has found a way to win so often. But I'll take Texas Tech, and then I'm going to have Texas Tech win the national championship. That's my pick. Sure to go wrong, but, like, I just think they're dynamic defensively. I do think they match up well with both teams, and I think they have a little bit more shot-making with Brandon Francis, with Matt Mooney, with Jared Culver than the other teams have at this level of play. something about Chris Beard and what his staff's been able to do, I think they'll win a national championship on Monday night. Thanks for listening. Make sure you download, subscribe, and rate. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is All Ball.